This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Protocol for Life Balance supplement product line. Protocol's mission is to provide top-quality supplements at affordable prices. Protocol offers 50 years of expertise, providing formulations based on the latest advances in nutritional science and incorporating trademarked ingredients that have been tested for efficacy in clinical trials and laboratory studies. I'm so confident in their products that I've included many of them in my Intelligent Medicine Lifestyle Protocols. Protocol for Life Balance is only available through licensed practitioners, so ask your doctor or healthcare professional for it by name. You can get them at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, which means you never know what questions are going to come across.
Yeah.
And that makes it interesting for us.
Yes.
And it also makes it interesting for our audience, because maybe that question is going to be relevant to a concern of yours or to someone who's a loved one in your family, friend. Mm-hmm. And so let's hear what we have.
Okay. We've got an email from Joanna. Thank you both for all the valuable information you convey to your listening public. I've learned so much over the years. Thank you. Joanna, thank you for listening. In a recent segment, you discussed the possibility of HDL cholesterol being too high, and the high figure you mentioned was anything over 60 to 80. I think she's referring to my podcast because I talked about that particular range.
Right.
Which is great, which is interesting. My last blood work showed an HDL level of 133 and a total cholesterol of 260. Of course, the doctor mentioned statins, and I declined letting her know that I would never consider taking a statin. Should I be concerned about the high HDL? And if so, what steps would you suggest I take?
Okay.
Now, what I had talked about on a recent Layla Weighs In podcast is I came across this article where they said that HDL too low can be as harmful as HDL that's too high, especially anything over the 60 to 80 range.
I think what you mean to say is HDL too high can be as bad as HDL too low.
That's, yes. Right. Did I not say that? That's what I meant to say.
You said it the other way around.
I said it the other way around. Thank you.
Because we know that HDL low is a risk factor.
Yes, it is.
And we know that HDL high is generally considered a protective factor.
The
more the merrier.
The more the merrier. Yeah. But apparently not so.
Right.
So there are certain
instances. Too much of a good thing can
be. Yes. Yeah. And what they looked at, and they didn't necessarily specify these patients' conditions, they just looked at their HDL. And they found that it was kind of a U-shaped curve in terms of benefit or risk, the risk. So they found an association. Again, this is not causality, it's association. They were observing. This, it's very important to make that distinction. It's not a randomized control trial or anything like that. They found that those with higher HDLs had the same kind of risk or had the same cardiac events.
But
as
not, not
those
invariably,
too low.
Because the way I interpret that study, I looked at the study in question. Mm-hmm. And the study in question from Denmark, they say has cast some doubt on the generality that a good HDL, you know, like a HDL ratio of 3 to 1 or better, we consider good. So if your cholesterol is 270, which is considered high, but your HDL is 90, that's a 3 to 1 ratio. So you're probably okay.
Yeah.
Even better, I mean, we see some patients who, like this last patient, was it like a 2 to 1 ratio? It was 270 with a, you know, HDL of 135, which is a 2 to 1 ratio. That's considered great.
Yeah.
But. So this study cast some doubt on the generality because they looked at more than 100,000 men and women for an average of 6 years. And they discovered a sweet spot for HDL. And that sweet spot, men with the lowest risk of heart disease had an HDL of 73. For women, the ideal HDL was higher. It was 93.
Okay,
so it was a little better.
Okay.
So, but men with extremely high HDL levels, which were 97 to 115, had a 36% increased risk of death. And that risk doubled among those whose HDL exceeded 116. And women whose HDL levels were above 135 had a 68% increased risk. Now, the problem with that study is even though it looked at 100,000 people, not, you know, even as 100,000 people, 6 years is not enough time to really ascertain the benefits or lack thereof. Because probably not that many people got sick and died in that group over 6 years.
Yeah.
I mean, some did. But only 2.3% of the men in the study had levels exceeding 97. And 0.3% of the women had HDL above 135. So it's probably very few individuals.
Yeah.
Now, so the way I construe it is that there are some conditions where you have a high HDL, which are unhealthy conditions.
Yes.
Which might predispose to problems. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you could take two people with an HDL of 135, and one might be at risk, and one might be super protected from cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
But on average, the risk increases, and it's not entirely clear why.
Yeah.
But a clue has come. You know, remember there was this drug that they decided was going to be a blockbuster drug.
Uh-huh.
Because now statin drugs just lower cholesterol, but yeah, they also lower HDL. So they came up with this idea, let's just raise the HDL and we'll give people incredible protection. And these drugs were called CETP inhibitors,
okay,
cholesterol ester transferase protein inhibitors. And what they found was disappointing. They found that those drugs didn't protect that much, mm-hmm, and actually created some problems. There is a genetic condition called CETP deficiency where people actually have higher, they have very high HDL, but they have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. And maybe that the CETP is essential for something, and
yeah,
so the HDL goes up, but the CETP deficiency creates, mm-hmm, a problem. So mm-hmm, that's maybe part of the equation, is that these people with the ultra-high HDL have a medical condition called CETP,
yeah,
deficiency. It's genetic. The other is certain medical conditions like hypothyroidism.
Yes, that's a big one.
Primary biliary cirrhosis or even alcoholism can cause
high HDL.
High HDL, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. That I haven't seen, but I've seen hypothyroidism, and I believe there was more research pointed to exposure to toxins.
Okay.
And that HDL going up is kind of a little bit of a rescue.
Yeah, it's like an anti-inflammatory thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And I wrote that, actually, and I'm going to write this in a blog that you can read, some of you may have already appeared. It appears that the protective effects of HDL itself, an anti-inflammatory compound, may be overwhelmed by high levels of inflammation. So
yes,
if you have high hsCRP in the presence of a high HDL, it may neutralize the benefits of the HDL.
There you go.
It's kind of like antioxidants become prooxidants in the presence of free radicals sometimes.
Okay. So, Joanna, the thing that you want to investigate, do you have hypothyroidism? That could be a reason for your high HDL.
But when it comes to whether this person should take a statin, they should get an EBT heart scan.
She's not going to.
No, she should get the scan. She should get the scan.
She's not going to take a statin.
No, but to reassure herself that she doesn't have plaque.
Yes.
Because
an EBT heart scan is a great
diagnostic. Yeah, because it might give her a really clean bill of health.
Mm-hmm.
I recently saw this in a patient who has a high cholesterol, 260 or something, and an HDL in the 90s.
Right.
And she had zero plaque.
There you go.
At the age of, like, in her 60s.
Mm-hmm. Those are the only two reasons I can think of for, or that third one that you just mentioned about that particular genetic mutation.
Mm-hmm.
So hypothyroidism, exposure to toxins, if you're go get tested with an integrative practitioner for, you know, your toxic exposures. That could tell you a lot. Get your thyroid panel done.
Look at your hsCRP, because that may counteract the benefits of the HDL.
Right, exactly. You don't want to get your hsCRP tested while you have a cold or have undergone some kind of a trauma where you fell down or you have muscle aches or pains.
Or after that running a marathon or something.
Exactly. So that could raise that hsCRP as well. So instead of what do I take for my high HDL, find out why you have that high HDL.
And if you don't have a problem, a lot of people say, well, I have high cholesterol, but I have no plaque, so I'll take something to lower the cholesterol. Don't bother. You know, don't take bergamot. Don't take red yeast rice.
You know,
don't bother. Do not pass go. Do not collect 200.
That high cholesterol may be saving your brain and your future brain.
Yeah. And moreover, here's the other thing.
Hmm.
Studies suggest that people who attain the age of 75 without heart disease don't benefit from statins. And actually, there's an inverse relationship between cholesterol and risk of dying.
Wow.
So,
I was just
talking to this woman. She says, my cholesterol is 300, but my husband's was 150. He died 5 years ago.
Exactly.
So it's not predictive.
And a total cholesterol lower than 160 may be a risk factor for cancer. You don't want that either. Cholesterol is also classified as an antioxidant, but that's not something your cardiologist knows. which is unfortunate.
Which is paint by numbers. Yeah, it's like, you know, see a high cholesterol, reach for the prescription pad.
Right.
No discerning, no discrimination, no investigation. Mm-hmm. It's easy.
Yeah. Yeah. They're also investigating more of the HDL particle sizes lately, not just the LDL.
Well, one can also do that. I didn't mention that, but one can look at the HDL and slice it and dice it just like you slice and dice the LDL, and you can find out if the HDL you have is the good HDL as opposed to the not-so-good HDL.
Right, right. Which are slightly different patterns. With LDL, it's a big, fluffy pattern A, desirable.
That's not a test done routinely. That's called an NMR or a lipoprotein. It's a...
VAPS test.
VAPS test, right.
NMR or VAPS, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones. So, Joanna, thank you very much for that question.
Okay, at this point, let's allow one of our sponsors to share an important message with you. Please listen up.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by True Niagen. New True Niagen Pro contains a unique form of vitamin B3, clinically proven to safely increase NAD, which is a vital resource used every day to help fuel and maintain the health of all living cells. NAD is critical for energy and cellular repair and supports muscle function. But as we age, NAD has been found to decline up to 50%. True Niagen Pro is clinically proven to safely increase NAD levels, caring for your cells to help you age better and live better. True Niagen Pro is only available through healthcare practitioners. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com to get yours.
Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our questions with Layla.
Here's a really good one from Diane. This could take up a whole podcast, however. What is a good diet for Sjogren's syndrome? Can it be cured?
Well, okay, so first of all, what's Sjogren's syndrome? It's got a weird spelling, Sjogrens.
Yes.
That's from the Swedish. The J is silent.
It's an autoimmune condition.
Yeah, and it's prevalent in Nordic people, but also we do see it in, dark-skinned people.
Yeah.
So it's a condition that I like to treat.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of forms of it. There's a form which is sort of a slow and indolent form, and there's a form that can be very rapid onset. It is associated with basically dry eyes, dry mouth, dry genital area, dry vaginal tissue.
Mm-hmm.
That, and so anybody who has those conditions, we might work up for Sjogren's.
Yeah.
It responds well, in my opinion, to high-dose vitamin D, mm-hmm. lots of fish oil, maybe some GLA, paleo diet,
or an autoimmune protocol, which includes the elimination, at the very least, of gluten and dairy, probably mm-hmm. nightshades, mm-hmm. and so forth. I mean, there are a few different versions of the paleo diet, and some are a little more stricter than others. The Paleo Mom does a really good one. Sarah Ballantyne is her name. It's called the Autoimmune Protocol, the AIP. She goes even farther than Lauren Cordain's paleo diet, but they're excellent, excellent therapeutic diets. Really, it's gold standard medical nutrition therapy, in my opinion. Can it be cured? I think it can be brought into remission, right? Dr. Hoffman, you and I kind of help that along to put autoimmune diseases like Sjogren's into remission.
Yeah, no, I have eliminating. I have hope mm-hmm. for controlling it.
Yeah.
The book that is authoritative on this is Amy Meyer's book, which is entitled The Autoimmune Diet.
Okay.
Let me see.
Okay. I think she's also written a book on thyroid, although many have written books on thyroid.
Which is an autoimmune condition. So the book is The Autoimmune Solution, and then mm-hmm. there's The Autoimmune Solution Cookbook, and she's also written a book, The Thyroid Connection.
Yeah.
Amy Myers, M-Y-E-R-S.
So Diane, the first thing would be to see a qualified nutritionist to put you on an autoimmune protocol specific to you,
mm-hmm.
and let's see that it goes into remission. That would be the objective.
Right.
Anyway, to see how that goes along.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, that could be an excellent result. So, yeah. Best of luck to you, Diane. Thank you for your question. We've got an email from Joan. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I was taking Prolia for osteoporosis. I had to have a tooth removed for an implant.
Uh-oh, I can see what's coming here.
Yeah. When the oral surgeon removed the tooth, quite a bit of bone came with it.
Mm-hmm. The doc- well, that's called osteonecrosis of the jaw.
Yeah.
Which is one of the side effects. We know it's a side effect of actinol, Beneva.
Those bisphosphonates.
Posamax. And what's the injectable one called?
Reclast.
Mm-hmm. But we now see it with Prolia.
Yeah. The doctor did a bone graft, and after many months, I have a new tooth. I understand that the reason for the bone loss in my jaw was due to the Prolia and the necrosis of the jaw. Needless to say, I'm no longer taking this drug. My question to you is, what can I now take in place of Prolia? Thank you for any help you can give me.
Well, you know, we very freely share our protocol on this, and there's a bone health protocol at dearhoffmanstore.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it consists of things like vitamin K2,
yes,
strontium,
Ostera,
which is a product by Metagenics, which mm-hmm. is a hops-derived anti-inflammatory product, mm-hmm. which, by the way, has actually some of the same beneficial characteristics as Prolia. It's not going to cause osteonecrosis of the jaw, but it's an anti-inflammatory mm-hmm. That works on a pathway similar to Prolia, but in a gentle way. We had one patient who was unable to take strontium for some reason. Usually that's unusual, but she just didn't react well to strontium. She took the Ostanol, and we saw an improvement. So I thought, well, that's interesting because
bone morphogenetic protein.
BMP. Morphogenetic protein, with Ostanol.
Yeah.
And also olive leaf has come into our protocol for this because we now know that, well, olive oil, the Mediterranean diet, has benefits, and it may be the compounds in olive oil that support bone.
Yeah. You want to make sure that your vitamin D levels are definitely above 40, preferably above 55. Mm-hmm. Magnesium is also very important.
And the cofactors, and the product is that we use for all the cofactors is now called Osteothera with Iproflavone.
Mm.
And Iproflavone is a non-hormonal...
protein from soy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very beneficial
for
bone. So those would be the things to take, Joan. Wow. And does this osteonecrosis tend to stop in its progression when we stop taking things like Prolia?
It probably doesn't get worse, but the concern is that some of these medications actually stop what's called the osteoclasts, and it allows bone to build up, but in an inefficient way.
Yeah. Okay.
The problem with a tooth or an implant is that it impairs bone genesis, actually, proper bone genesis.
That's interesting.
And healing, because bone healing requires both osteoclast and osteoblast. In other words, demolition while construction mm-hmm. is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cancel out one of those things, you will get a net gain in construction, but maybe at the expense of structure.
Yeah. Interesting. Joan, best of luck to you. All right. Let's see here. We have an email from Carol. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm in the UK and wondered if your joint supplement was okay to take if you're on anticoagulants like Eliquis. Over in the UK, it's called Apixaban, but it's the same as Eliquis. I looked it up.
Yeah.
I notice it contains turmeric, the joint supplement, which is supposed to thin the blood.
That proposition's a little oversold, I find.
Yeah.
Is in a lot of the warnings about anticoagulants now, when they look at drug-nutrient interactions, they include turmeric among the drug-nutrient interactions, as if the turmeric is going to suddenly make you bleed. I think that that's theoretical. I don't know if there's any real studies that show that that's the case, or even anecdotes that show that somebody took turmeric on top of a blood thinner and had serious, dangerous bleeding.
Yeah. My understanding is there's a such thing as possibly too much turmeric, but what that is could be 6 to 8 capsules of it a day, which really isn't being suggested. no, right. to anyone. Or,
So it would be a shame, you know, for someone who has the need for these blood thinners to forego the benefits of turmeric.
Yeah, yeah. So
if they allow you to do that in the UK, I don't know. Things are pretty strict over there, I understand.
Mm.
It's,
yeah.
I, you know, if we think that there's a problem with access to supplements in this country, forget about it over there. I've got a British colleague who talked to when I've interviewed, and he says that the Europeans are really draconian about restricting supplements. And one of the problems is that sometimes we want to internationalize and harmonize the rules. And if we were to adopt the European rules here, a lot of our supplements would disappear. So
is that the Commission E? Or
Commission
is that...
E, yeah. We, let's hear it for national sovereignty. Is like, you know, we're American. We're going to... The hell with those people, you know, it's like...
That's not how we want to do things, thank you.
Right.
We don't want to answer to you.
Yep.
Yep. Oh, my. So, okay. Carol, thank you for listening.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to have listeners that's so great. Across the world.
Oh,
boy. We have time for one more.
Oh, okay. All right. Good morning, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Okay, are we sitting down? My daughter was told by her lactation coach that exercising would make her breast milk sour. Does that make sense? This is from Kevin. When I read this, I wanted to laugh.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I've not been a lactation coach myself. I know it was one of my first internship rotations at the time up at Jacoby Medical Center, where we had to advise on lactation for a short stint.
So this is unfortunately, a lactation consultant who is promulgating an old wives' tale.
Ah,
and you know, yes, there's traditional wisdom, but there's also traditional BS.
Yeah,
frankly, and that's what that is. And okay,
so I've never heard this in all my practice.
Here's the theory: when you exercise a lot, you build up lactic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that lactic acid, you know, causes
it's
going to
sour the milk.
it's not because
it's not.
It may make your muscles feel tired.
Yeah.
But that lactic acid dissipates very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, it's buffered. So if you check the acidity of somebody's blood after exercise, it may go down a tick.
Mm.
But my goodness, it's so regulated, homeostatically regulated, you will counteract and buffer out the acidity of the lactic acid. Otherwise, you know, many of your organs would have problems. You know, your heart, your brain,
yes.
You know. So it is almost inconceivable that your breast milk would partake of the little lactic acid that you get in your thighs or you're in your calves from exercise. And it's just nuts. Now, so I'm reading here, you know, breastfeedingusa.com. Research shows that moderate exercise doesn't affect milk supply, milk composition, or baby's growth. Levels return to normal within an hour, and the impact on a baby is unlikely to be significant. So here's what I will say is that, you know, maybe when you're lactating is not the time to really do heavy training because the body will perceive this as, oh my goodness, we're being chased by saber-toothed tigers.
Yeah.
And there's threat and danger, you know, and you're adrenalized and you're in a state of high cortisol, and that may, you know, curtail your milk production.
Yeah.
Most lactating women intuitively understand that.
Hmm.
You know, they just don't feel like exercising that much. Yeah, they'll go to a yoga class or they'll do some
lactation.
Light.
Nursing burns a lot more calories than pregnancy.
It does.
So they may be feeling
it
that.
Does. We have a family member who's in, and she got to be an eating machine. Because she's eating for two.
Yeah, you have to eat to nurse.
It's tough enough to keep up. You know, it's like I can imagine, like, I'm eating to keep up with my own physical demands, but like somebody else's physical demands. Caloric demands.
I remember my mother had to do that when she was nursing my sister, who was practically 9 years younger than me. And she kept having, even while she was breastfeeding, I remember she was feeding herself. And I just thought that was, wow.
Right.
So, this is a myth, apparently. I've never heard of breast milk turning sour unless you pump and you leave it on the kitchen counter overnight. And nobody wants to drink that.
This could
that.
Be a new thing. It could be like breast milk yogurt or breast milk kefir.
Breast milk Yoplait.
Right, really. I mean, this could be a whole new thing. It might be appealing to the baby. Because, I mean, actually, we are taught to like sour flavors. Mm. Sour is the taste of acid.
Tart. Sour.
Yeah, and it's actually appealing, and it stimulates the appetite, mm-hmm. and it actually makes you salivate a little bit.
Yes.
That whole thing. So I just did the reason I say that is I just did a really excellent podcast on the subject of why we eat what we eat. That's the name of the book by Rachel Hertz. Mm-hmm. She's a neuroscientist, and she talks about what the flavors do to us from a sensory standpoint, and you know how they operate on us in mm-hmm. terms of food preferences and cravings, and you know salt, sweet, bitter, umami even.
Yes.
And you know, and it's really fascinating, the physiology of taste and smell, and how it guides our food preferences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So, Kevin, hopefully we busted that myth.
Yeah.
Okay. Myth busting here.
That's
that was
right.
For the last question.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Great questions. Thank you. Keep sending them. Radioprogram@AOL.com. These are going to be hard to top.
Yeah. So keep sending.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence. And this is our weekly Q&A with Layla. Thanks for joining us. This is Intelligent Medicine.
This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.